Okay, so the main part of my talk is going to be on the interpretation of interference experiments in real quantum Hall systems. And this is theoretical work that I've done with Bernd Rosenau, Adi Stern, who's here, Izar Nader, who's at now a student, a postdoc at Harvard. And it was motivated by experimental work. Originally, for me, work at Harvard in Charlie Marcus's group by Yiming Zhang, Doug McClure, and Angela Ku, and who also, and we had a lot of discussions with them. They contributed also to the theory as well as the theoretical picture. And also, there were similar experiments going on at the Weizmann Lab in Monty Heidblum's group. Nisim Ofek, I guess the student who's most responsible, also had interactions with them and learned a lot from them. And they were both, that also fed in a lot to what I want to talk about. Now, I was invited by the, I was asked by the organizers to say also a little bit of introductory stuff. Originally, I guess my talk was supposed to be yesterday, but I couldn't make it until today, about quantum Hall systems. And I guess what since there is quite a bit of work on quantum Hall systems to be discussed here, I'd just like to take a few minutes to remind people of why quantum Hall systems are still very interesting after some 28 years or something since the first effect has been discovered. Of course, the reason is that the systems are very rich. It's not just one effect. There are many, many effects that occur in these systems. There are many different phases. There are phase transitions between them. And there's a lot that we still don't understand, of course. Not only is the phenomena complex, but the theory of it is very complex. We've used, to try to understand what's going on, we've used tricks and methods from all branches of from field theory, from topology, from it's hard to think of another branch of physics other than maybe high temperature superconductors, which has brought in as many different methods of looking at things that. But I think in this case, we can all say that they've produced a lot of enlightenment in high-temperature superconductivity. Well, you might have different views. In any case, the systems also show a lot of different striking phenomena, some which are quite striking. There are, although most of the work has been done in gallium arsenide, there are also new materials which are now being studied, like graphene and new things that get very interesting. There are a lot of new and improved techniques which over the years have enabled us to study new, to see new phenomena. Whoops, how do I, there we go. Of course we have had continuing surprises and many unanswered questions. Now a lot of the work that we're interested in has to do with the nature of the systems in the bulk two-dimensional system, and especially, I think, in recent years, there's been a tremendous amount of interest of what happens in the second Landau level, where things are really maybe in some ways least understood. Of course, the five-halves state is the focus of a lot of attention, and people are still debating what's that, what's the seven-thirds, eight-thirds, twelve-fifths, various, almost everything that's seen there is not particularly well understood. And of course, we would like to know whether some or all of these states are non-abelian states. And again, this is the focus of a lot of attention, both theoretically and experimentally. And I think the only thing I can say is that the problem is very interesting, but it's too difficult for theorists to decide by themselves or for experimentalists to decide by themselves. And so that makes it really interesting, because I think the only way we're going to find out is by a lot of cooperation between theorists and experimentalists. And to the extent that we have to compare theory and experiment, we also have to think a lot about what the real materials are doing. And what are the roles of various sample parameters, including density, well, thickness of the wells, and the amount of disorder in deciding what happens? It's not necessarily universal. There are a lot of other open questions in quantum Hall systems, even quite apart from the from the second lambda level. And I would just mention that I think in general, what happens at finite temperatures in fractional regimes and so forth is not especially well understood, particularly in the presence of disorder. There hasn't been a lot of focus on that recently, but I think you'll at least hear some of that. For example, in Jim Eisenstein's talk, and we can ask about questions of should there be phase transitions of various kinds, or if not actual phase transitions, but maybe not sharp phase transitions, but smeared out phase transitions from as a function of temperature, you go from one regime to another. And then another question, which I've always been worried about, been interested in from the very beginning, is even going back to the integer quantum Hall effects, is what actually determines the activation gaps that you see in transport measurements when you have some disorder. You know, what is the relation between what you see and what you calculate in some theory? And I don't think this is well understood, and I've spent a lot of time trying to understand it with not much success. Now, of course, recently we have these attention paid to multi-valley systems, like graphene, aluminum arsenide. We get some new phenomena. There are a lot of interesting things in bilayer systems, and I think you'll hear about a lot of these things here. By the way, I made up a list of these things without looking at the program for the conference, but then when I looked at the program for the conference, I could see that most of the things I picked out as the most interesting things are going to be talked about here, so that should make it very interesting. There are many phenomena in higher lambda level, which maybe isn't going to be talked about here, including the stripe and bubble phases, and something that I think is still not that well understood is these microwave-induced resistance oscillations and so forth. So all of these have to do with bulk systems. But of course, a lot of the experiments have to do with edges, and a lot of the interesting problems also have to do with edges. So either edges or maybe mesoscopic geometries of various kinds. In particular, one of the things that main thing I'm going to be talking about will be a transport in systems with a narrow constriction. That's a quantum point contact. And there are a lot of these measurements, including shot noise and current correlation experiments, as well as nonlinear conductivity, which may be interesting for a single junction or several. Systems with two or more constrictions, we start getting into interferometer geometries, which is what I want to mainly talk about. And the experiments on these edges are interesting for a lot of reasons. They may be one of the reasons is they may be the best way of learning about what goes on in the bulk, in particular to try to decide between abelian or non-abelian states. Interference experiments might be the key. It may be that in some of the experiments you're dominated by things that are peculiar to the edges and they're very sensitive to edge reconstructions, and they're telling us something about the properties of edges, which I think is interesting in its own right. So those are two reasons. And as I mentioned, one of the things that got me most interested in a few years ago was the realization that interference experiments could be a way of determining whether, say, the 5/2 state has or does not have non-abelian statistics. I mean, as I started to look into actual experiments done with interference, I realized that at least I didn't understand what was going on, even in the simplest cases of integer, the integer quantum Hall effect. And so I decided I better try to understand that. And so I've spent a certain amount of time and my colleagues trying to sort out what happens in real experiments, which have complications, even in the integer case, or in simple odd denominator fractions, which I found out we didn't understand that well. And I think we now understand them a lot better. And that's the main thing that I want to talk about for the rest of my talk. And in fact, I'm going to focus almost entirely on the integer quantum Hall effect and the situation of just the simplest to understand, at least, the basic Fabry-Perot interferometer with two constrictions. And I should say that, as I indicated at the beginning, there are some theoretical advances, but there have also been important experimental advances which have helped us. So one is that there are improved methods of gating and separately controlling the densities in the bulk and in the constrictions, which I think have helped sort out a lot of what's going on. And people have learned, you know, said, well, let's look at a lot of different samples of different sizes and prepared in different ways, which also is important. Another thing which is which I think has at least helped me a lot was the various experimental groups have started to, they've gotten to the point where they can do continuously measurements of resistance oscillations as a function of both the magnetic field, which you can vary, and the voltage applied to some gate, a side gate or a back gate. And so you can make now two-dimensional plots of how things vary, and you can see things a lot better when they, and in particular, one of the things that will be the heart of what I want to talk about is how you can get qualitatively different behavior in different regions, which you can distinguish most easily by looking at the slope of lines of constant phase on these two-dimensional plots. And I will try to, I hope I can explain that to you in my talk. And, well, let me just show you what it is. So this is work from Zhang's paper, and the two different types of behavior, which I will try to explain, is, let's see, how is this? There we go. Okay, so this is magnetic field going this way, increasing this way, and voltage going this way, and these are lines of constant phase and interference experiment. And you see here, we see the on the lines slanting to the right. Here we see lines slanting to the left, so that the relation between the magnetic field variation and the basically the effect of the magnetic field has opposite sign in the two effects. And this they call the Aronoff-Ohm region. This they call a Coulomb blockade region. I don't like that name exactly. I'll call it a Coulomb dominated region, and I'll try to explain where that comes from. Okay, so we're talking about a Fabry-Perot interferometer, and I'm talking about the integer regime. And so the idea is we have two constrictions, and we have a bulk island in between them. And in the constrictions, I have a certain number of channels which are supposed to be perfectly transmitted. They correspond to lambda levels 1, 2, up to Ft. The number may be 0. There may be nothing transmitted perfectly, but there could be some number of them. Here, these are a channel is a spin split lambda level. So, okay. So, and there's one channel which is partly transmitted. It's partly backscattered. It may be weakly or strongly backscattered. And then there may be additional channels which exist in the bulk, but are completely don't enter the constrictions at all. They're completely backscattered, if you wish. And that will happen if the bulk density is larger than in the constrictions. Then J could. There could be quite a few of those. Okay, so the filling fraction in the constriction then, which I call nu c, it's something between Ft and Ft plus 1. Because Ft are completely transmitted, and Ft plus, yes, it's right. If this thing were maybe the easiest way to explain it is with a figure. So this is an illustration which will show what I mean in a particular case where I have, so here I have three channels all together, okay? One of them, the innermost channel, is completely backscattered, okay? And the outermost one goes through. Now, I can consider two different situations. So one is if I have the filling fraction in the constriction here is 2 minus epsilon. So this means that this second channel here is partly backscattered. That's what these black... It's weakly backscattered. That would be filling fraction 2 minus epsilon. So it's slightly less than 2, so some of that's scattering back. Or I could consider a situation where there was no backscattering of this channel. It was completely transmitted, so Ft would be 2. But this one here might be slightly forward scattered. Or you could equivalently say that this one, the third one, is very strongly backscattered and only very weakly transmitting. So that would be weak forward scattering. That then this is that would be ft equals 2. And in that case, that would correspond to nu c being slightly bigger than the constriction being, the filling fraction being slightly bigger than epsilon, than 2. And in all cases, we have 3 plus or minus epsilon in the bulk. So these are the two ways this works. So let me, and I'm going to concentrate on the weak backscattering limit. So so we have a partially transmitted channel, which I'll call J0, which is numbered FT plus 1. That's the weakly backscattered one. And the filling fraction is J0 minus epsilon. Okay, and let me think about a situation where I have a very small source. Yeah. No, okay, so you could have, if the constriction's really narrow, you may have two or more. So I'm going to restrict myself to assume that the constriction is, let's say the bottom of the constriction is sufficiently flat so that there's basically, so you're right, there could be situations where there are two channels that can be scattered. But the simplest case is where you have a gradual change of density and then only one of them, and only in one case are the edges close enough together so that it can't make up its mind whether to go through or not. So it's sort of like a saddle point that you're coming close to. But you're right, this is not the most general possible thing. But okay. All right, so we have a very small source drain voltage. So I'm looking at just the infinitesimal resistance. And, I'm sorry, I should have just, let me go back. Okay, so we're going to measure this thing called RD, which is the voltage difference between this contact and this contact when you put a current through. And this, if there's no backscattering, this will be just the Hall voltage that you're measuring. And this can go up or down, depending whether you have forward scattering or backscattering. And the point is that the backscattering will give you a contribution to the resistance, which will have an interference in it if things are coherent. And that interference will be the real part of transmission amplitude on one, transmission amplitude squared on the other, times a phase factor, e to the I phi. And phi is the phase that's accumulated by this channel J. It's this phi J for the one that goes all the way around. J equals J naught. Sorry, with PowerPoint, I can't make a subscript or a subscript. So it's phi J naught, which is important. There's one edge that's important, and it's that phase that we care about. It's the phase that's accumulated. It's a difference in phases on the two sides, or the phase that would be accumulated by a particle, an electron, going all the way around. And the idea is to calculate this phase. What is it? It's not so obvious. In order to calculate the phase, let me remind you what we think about the structure of an edge. So the edge, so this is my picture of the edge. In the bulk, we assume we have there's a Landau level, let's say one Landau level, let's think about, a particular Landau level. And that Landau level has a width, which could be due to disorder or to electron-electron interactions. It's some combination of the two. But I'm going to make the assumption that so we can think about it sort of this way. We have a certain width of a Landau level. And at the center of the Landau level, we have an extended state. And above and below this, we have localized states. They're localized by some combination of interaction and disorder. If we have a near the edge, and these are spin split, of course. So near the edge, we have a gradually varying density or a gradually varying potential. So the energy of the Landau level is changed as a function of position. And as we get to the edge, we're assuming that the density gradient is fairly small on the scale of the magnetic length near the edge. So we can talk about the energy at a given position. What we really mean is the energy at the guiding center. The actual wave function is, of course, much more spread out. And it goes up. And there's some point at which the extended state cuts through the Fermi surface. So we have an extended state extended in the direction perpendicular to the screen. It's localized in the direction, in this direction. And that's the edge state at the Fermi level. Question? Well, it doesn't enter in any quantitative way, so I'm not sure. I'm assuming it's reasonably wide. So that, and I think in practice, of course, we know that what will happen is the potential will readjust itself in such a way that almost everywhere is there are states at the Fermi level. There's very unlikely to be any place where there's no states at the Fermi level, because then we would build up charge. So this is schematic. I think the actual thing may be more complicated, but I think this is good enough for this picture. But the important thing is that now when I think about the charge, okay, so the important thing is that I have this point here, but there are states in the lambda level both inside and outside. And outside, let's say, I still will have some states occupied, but they'll be localized states. So I have some number of electrons in localized states outside this position xj, which is the position of the where the edge comes through, and there'll be localized holes inside. Okay, but the important thing about these localized states is that they're either occupied or unoccupied, and their occupation numbers are integers. Okay, all right. And so now, if I want to think about that, what I would like to think about is the total charge in the Landau level, and I can make that up of, so basically it's going to be the charge that I would have had. I can compute a charge as if my Fermi level, every state was occupied up to this, what happens to this point here, and that would give me basically the total flux that's enclosed by the area. But then in addition, I have an integer number of localized electrons outside, and I have to subtract an integer number of localized holes inside. So if I look at the charge, if I have a closed edge, so one of these states that doesn't go through, then the total charge enclosed by the loop has to be an integer, because the charge enclosed by the loop, not including the electron charges, not including the localized charges, it's just given by the area times the magnetic field, the number of flux quanta, and that has to be an integer if I have Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization rules for closed orbit. On the other hand, if it's an open orbit, because it goes through the constrictions, then there's no such quantization rule, there can be an arbitrary phase difference as I go around, which is the phase difference that I'm trying to calculate is precisely the area, the number of flux quanta enclosed by this loop, by this area AJ, which is the area of the extended state, which could vary. It doesn't necessarily, we're going to have to look at how it varies. And in particular, as I vary my flux or vary the area, this NJ can now vary continuously for an open edge. Now the total charge in the lambda level is given by this NJ, which is continuous, plus the number of particles in localized states outside minus number of holes inside. And these PJ, P and H, those are integers. So the charge in a lambda level is the sum of a continuously varying part plus integer. That's very important in what I want to talk about. Now I have to decide what are these numbers. What's the area AJ? What's the value of AJ? And what are these integers? And I want to think about if I have zero source drain voltage, so I'm trying to calculate this by minimizing some energy. And the energy consists of a Coulomb charging energy, which can be very large, plus other pieces, which I'll talk about in a minute. So this Coulomb charging energy, there's some constant K, which is just 1 over the capacitance of this island. And if I had a top gate, for example, that would vary as the area. 1 over K would vary as the area of the island. So the larger the area, the smaller K. And then the total charge is first of all, this Q, which is the sum of all the electrons in the various lambda levels that I talked about, which has both a continuous and integer part, minus some N naught. A naught is the positive background that's already in that area. A naught is some reference area. A naught is the area of the dot in the absence of any magnetic field, let's say. The individual AJs can vary slightly. And then if I put a gate voltage on, I can change the area by some amount proportional to the gate voltage, and also I might change the density, delta NJ, by some amount, so there could be a density change and area change due to the gate, depending on where the gate is located, whether it's a top gate or a side gate and so forth. Okay, and so I have to add all this stuff up, that's the total charge, and square it, and that's the charging energy. In addition, we know that there's something that wants the the edge states to occur at a particular place, namely close to the edge, a certain distance in from the edge, depending on the magnetic field and so forth. So there's going to be some restoring force if I try to move that, if I try to change the area enclosed by a loop, which means displacing the edge in or out, it's going to cost me some energy, and maybe there's some coupling term between them. So this, the amount that this energy cost here, there's some coefficients uij, which I don't know what they are, and this is an important point, but and then it's going to be equal to the difference of the actual area, aj, which determines the amount of flux enclosed by this lambda level, minus what it would like to be in the absence of a magnetic field, which is this a naught plus some constant that depends on which lambda level I'm talking about, plus this delta AG, because if I have a gate on, it can change the area. This delta AG is just this area change here. So that goes in here, and I would have cross terms, and I want to minimize both of the sum of these things. Okay? Now, I can think about different regimes. The simplest regime is what we call the Arnoff Bohm regime. It's where this, if this K is negligibly small, so I forget about this, and I just have to minimize this term here. And of course, since if I'm just looking at the orbits that go through, then of course this aj is continuous. It can be anything. So I can obviously minimize this by simply setting delta ai equals zero for all of the i's. And that will be, that's what happens in the sort of simplest non-interacting picture. We'll see what happens. Let me just say one word of justification for this capacitance charging model. Why can I get away by just using one charging energy for the entire system? It's not obvious that I can do that. And my argument here is that the electrons and holes in localized states, they don't move very fast because they're localized, but they can move. They can move by two particle processes. Maybe they can't move by readjusting themselves. And they do this on some time scale, which is slow compared to the time it takes an electron to go around the loop, but fast on a laboratory's time scale. So if I adjust my gate voltage or my magnetic field and wait a few milliseconds or something, these will adjust. And so they will screen, and they will basically behave like a metal. All these localized states behave like a metal, subject to the constraint of the total charge being fixed. But they will redistribute themselves so that I have, in the end, it's like a good metal where I can characterize it by a single capacitance. Sorry, okay. All right, so the Arnoff-Bohm regime, we set K equals zero, we minimize this AI, but AJ is precisely, so we have, so we this thing I call delta AJ, I set it to be equal to zero, and that in the end means that AJ, to set delta AJ equals zero, it means AJ just takes on the value determined by the gate voltage and delta B, and you get something that looks like this. So the phase change is A naught times delta B plus B times delta AG. So it's the change that you would get by changing the area by the amount decided by delta AG plus changing the magnetic delta B, and this gives you a situation where lines of constant phase obviously have A naught delta B plus B delta AG is equal to a constant. So if I wanted to plot a line of constant slope versus delta B and AG, AG is proportional to VG with a positive constant, so this would be lines that would have negative slope. That's the AB regime. And the flux period, well, to change this by 2 pi, I have to add change the flux by the magnetic field by 1 over A0 in units of the flux quantum. So it's one flux area. And the flux period, similarly, is delta AG is 1 over B. Okay. Yep. Right. So, okay. So there's a charge grid. Okay. All right. So now the opposite regime is the more interesting one. I should have stayed with that for a moment. Let me go back a second. Okay. So now we want to minimize this thing as far as possible. But then there's still we still have some. having minimized this as much as possible, we still can choose what delta A is. So we basically are going to wind up with this. We're going to basically set this quantity in here equal to zero, okay? But this quantity itself doesn't now determine delta A. I read off what the value, I have to take the result of this, Q has an A in it, and I put that in here, and without going through the algebra, what I find out is that in this case, somewhat not surprisingly, this phi that I get is pieces that there's a piece that's linear in the gate voltage, this n naught delta A g plus a naught delta g, and then there's a piece that involves the number of channels. Times b times the field plus this delta a g plus the part that comes, this integer part. And what I've done here, I should say, there's one other thing I've done. I've made the assumption that basically it's much easier to change the area of the innermost one that goes through than the ones that are closer to the edge. So almost all, when I put extra flux in, when I try to put, or if I try to put extra charge in, it tries to go rather than it tries to go into these the one that's partially transmitted, and so it therefore affects the phase here. Okay, and we have to basically, we're trying to get charge neutrality as close as we can, effectively soaking up whatever extra charge I have to put in by varying the, if I put in the magnetic field or vary gate voltages, I try to soak up all the charge I can, either with these integers or with changing the area of this this partially transmitted ring, which is this AJ. And that gives me this phase here. Now, of course, the integer itself depends on the occupations of localized states, and it can change. If I vary magnetic field, it can jump. In general, this integer will change. But as far as the interference is concerned, it's e to the I phi over 2 pi, so changing this integer has no effect. So I can have all kinds of jumps as I vary my magnetic field in the occupation numbers of these localized states without having an effect, direct effect on the exchange, at least within, if this equation is right, if the within this approximation. And so therefore, I can just forget about it. And I want to ask, how does the phase change when I vary AG by a small amount, the gate voltage by a small amount, or B by a small amount? I just take the derivative of this and ignore any change in the integer, because if the integer changes, which will happen every once in a while, it doesn't do anything for me. So then I get a very simple answer that the change in phi is linear in the change in the gate voltage from this term and from this term. And then there's a piece that's linear in the magnetic field. And now you see these come in with opposite sign. At least if Ft is not zero, if the number of transmitted channels, completely transmitted channels is not zero, then increasing the gate voltage makes the phase go up, and this makes it go down. And so then you see we get this lines of phi then have positive slope in this case if Ft is different from zero. Again, because AG and VG both increase, the coefficients are positive. The area change and the density change vary positively with the gate voltage. On the other hand, if Ft is equal to zero, so no states are transmitted, totally transmitted, then the magnetic field has no effect, basically. And then you'd see that you'd get lines which are horizontal. And this would be the case, for example, if the constriction, if the constriction is slightly less than one, so there's no channel that goes through, only the nu equals one channel goes partially through the constriction, but none go completely through, then you would have independent, okay. And again, you can calculate the flux period from this formula, and clearly to change phi by one, I have to change delta B by an amount, which is minus 1 over Ft times this area. So the flux quantum, the number of flux quanta is 1 over Ft. Okay, and then you can calculate the area periods and the back gate period. You can also calculate, they're a bit more complicated. Okay, so everything I've told you about so far is in weak backscattering. We'll stay with that for a moment. I told about the strong Coulomb blockade, Coulomb effect region and the weak region. What happens if you're in between? How do you go from Arnulf Bohm to Coulomb dominated? Well, you see both. What happens is you go from this behavior to this behavior by seeing both of them at once. This is a calculation by Bernd Rosenau for a particular case of Ft equals 1. So nu c, the constriction has 2 minus epsilon. So this is not the scale. But anyway, so we have slope going one direction, the other direction. And in between, you see one of them, you see both of them. One gets stronger and the other gets weaker. And that's how you go from one to the other. And I think that's crudely what's seen in experiments, but this isn't certainly traced out. Okay, so everything so far has been in the case of very weak backscattering. So we're just on the 2 minus, slightly the high field side of a constriction. And now what happens if you have intermediate or strong backscattering? So in that case, we're varying, the constriction is varying between Ft, so Ft equals 1 minus epsilon, that was weak scattering. Ft equals 1 minus 1, which is nu c equals Ft would be the strong backscattering region. So we have the whole region between we have 2 plateaus, and we're going along from one region to another. And what the prediction is that, in fact, the period as far as the magnetic field is concerned just is the same along the whole thing. We have the same, the period doesn't change as you go between the plateaus. It only changes when you go from one plateau to another. Then Ft goes from Ft to Ft plus 1, then you get your change. And the gate periods are a little more complicated. But this seems to be consistent with experiments. So this is actually, again, from Yiming's work. And so here, as you can see, this is going from filling fraction 4 to filling fraction 5. And here's filling fraction 6 to filling fraction 7. And you see all these oscillations. And the period is really constant over each of these, but it's different between these two. And I think that's the same thing that also seen in Mucky's lab and Goldman lab also. Okay, so let me just say a word here about a comparison to earlier work that we did. So Bernd Rose and I wrote a paper on this. We're interested in this integer regime a couple of years ago, appeared in PRL 2007, and we didn't have as good a picture at that time, but I think the results are basically the same. In particular, in the limit of strong backscattering, what we're finding now is exactly what we found in that paper. In the weak backscattering case, in that paper we had an adjustable constant, which was a ratio of coupling constants. And if one was called delta x, the other was called delta, it doesn't much matter. But if we took, we didn't really know how to calculate them. If delta x over delta is 1, if you said, then you get exactly the Arnulf Bohm, you get the, the Coulomb-dominated regime that we just talked about. But we didn't have a good reason. I think we now understand why it should be very close to 1. We have a better physical picture. And if we set delta x over delta equals 0, then you get the Arnulf Bohm like regime. So it's in there, but we didn't really have as good a picture of it. And the other thing we didn't talk about, we didn't think about in that paper, was this question of what if you measure dependence on B and VG simultaneously and look at the slope, the change in slope, was something we didn't think about at all. And I think that's very important. Let's see, a few more minutes. Finite source drain voltage. So everything I've talked about so far is in weak, if you have just put an infinitesimal voltage difference in between the two contacts and measure the resistivity, you can also do experiments at finite source drain voltage and ask what happens. And so we've looked at that, and other people have looked at that. The general prediction is that you look at this is the oscillatory part of the current. There's a total current, but then we can vary the magnetic field or the gate voltage and look at the part that oscillates. So there's a visibility, if you wish, of the interference fringes. But the delta I should look like some function of the voltage. V is the difference in the voltages between the two sides, the voltage difference, times let's say, a phase, cosine of phi naught plus phi. So f of v is an envelope function, which is very interesting because it's predicted to be non-monotonic in the voltage v. And phi naught is the interference phase that you would find at v equals zero. Okay, and then if you put a voltage on, there can be a phase shift, capital phi, which in general for small v would be linear in this in both v1 and v2, and the coefficients can be different. It depends on the symmetry and so forth, and it's a complication. But in most cases, you can argue that a and b are small, so we're going to neglect this. But actually, I think there might be some interesting cases where a and b are not small, and we've been thinking about whether that can be seen. I think in the existing experiments, we can neglect a and b. So we neglect this extra term, and we just have to focus on the envelope function. Now the envelope function, this was pointed out first by Shimon et al, where they first talked about these, a very nice paper where they talked about all the different interference effects you can see. So if we have, say, non-interacting electrons, or we have nu equals one single edge stake, then this f of v is very simple. It's just a sine function of v times tau, and tau is the time it takes for an electron to move halfway around the system. So that's what you get with a single edge state. Now, if you have many edge states, it gets more complicated. It depends a lot on details. But if we think about a situation where let's think about the Aronoff Bohm regime, we have say some number of fairly large number perhaps of states in the bulk, the filling fraction. Nu c, this fb is basically the filling fraction in the bulk, and nu b rather is the filling fraction. This fb is the filling fraction in the bulk, and some number of them get through, and some don't. And we have typically we'll have in this case Coulomb interactions between the edge states on a single edge, but let's neglect if we're in the Aronoff Bohm regime, we may not have to worry about the Coulomb interaction between different edges. Then each edge will be, we have to renormalize, we would normally have a bunch of independent particles, we'd have velocities for each edge mode, but now with the Coulomb interactions, you tend to put one velocity goes way up, and the others, the neutral modes, remain more or less what the old ones were. And let's just think about a situation like that, just to give you the simplest case. And there's one mode in the middle here, which is partially transmitted, and that couples to these linearly to these other modes. And what you wind up with in that case, again, is that delta I, it's some envelope function times cosine of phi naught, but f is now not a simple sine function, but it has some structure to it. It also tends to oscillate and change sign. And again, in the simplest case, where the velocities of the adjacent modes are not too different, you may wind up with something which is some Bessel function, basically. But it's going to look something like a sine of v. Whoops, there should be a tau in here, but plus some phase shift, and it falls off with some power law. And if you have several modes contributing, then you can get beats, and you can get all kinds of complicated things. But in the simplest approximation, we might just approximate this whole thing by a simple sine wave, and indeed that seems to work for at least in the experiments that Zhang et al. Do. They actually, v is just applied to one side, they measure di dv, not I, so di dv, we have to differentiate this, and we get a cosine of v tor times cosine of phi naught, so it's the product, if you use the simple formula, which really goes back to Shimon, Wen et al., then you get just the product of two cosines. And indeed, well, that sort of works. Here's their paper. This is the model, which is just the product of two cosines, and here's the experiment. So it's like the product of two cosines because it does fall off as the voltage gets larger for perhaps a variety of reasons. Okay, so I just want to, my time is almost up. Let me just say one minute left. Okay, well, it should take me about 1 minute. So I've talked only about integer case. It's not hard to generalize these ideas to fractional case, you just have to make sure you do the bookkeeping very carefully, because now when you put extra charges in, if they're fractional charges, they have fractional statistics as well. And if you're trying to calculate phase shifts of some quasi-particle going around the edge, you want to make sure you take that into account. And I'm not going to go through all of it, but just as an example of the sort of thing you get, and things do depend on how many channels are transmitted. And just, for example, if you're looking at constriction, if you have, say, a constriction where if we're in a fractional quantum Hall regime where the density in the constriction is between a third and two-fifths, so we're assuming the one-third state gets through the constriction very well, it's fully transmitted, and the two-fifths is not, then you would get, in this case, a flux period, which is 1 over A0. In other words, you have to add one full flux quantum of magnetic flux in order to change the interference phase by 2 pi. So this looks just like what you would get if I was in the integer case between 1 less than, where the constriction filling was between 2 and 1. So okay, and you can go through this for all different kinds of filling fractions. There could be some huge table of things, but that's the idea, I think, is basically there. Okay, so anyway, I think we've made a number of approximations, and so I don't expect any of these slopes and so forth to be exactly correct. And by assuming that all of the area is taken up by one mode and not the others, that's a bit of a questionable approximation. We don't know how to calculate some of the really basic things. So this picture is still, I think, a bit, I would say that, it still needs more work to make sure it's correct, but it seems to describe the data pretty well, and it seems to be pretty reasonable, and I think one can probably apply this to other interference experiments. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have time for questions or discussion.
The local, you mean in the bulk or in the constriction? Yes. Right, yes. Yes, so of course this is an important point. In most of my discussion, I assumed that we had integer states only, so I didn't ask what would happen if I had a contact which would say, if the contact is very narrow, and then you would sort of think, well, the large gradients, I probably can't establish any kind of collective effect in there, and I probably can understand what's going on in the constriction by thinking just about the integers. But if the channel is wider, you can get something else. And in Nisimovec's work, for example, he has a situation where you have it's pretty well established four-thirds state. So you have one. It's between 1 and 2, but it's smooth enough so that you have something which is basically looks like it's, well, okay, I don't know how, maybe Mati can tell how well it's established that the one-third can go through. Now, the experiments that I think he talks about is where the one-third doesn't go through completely, so it's not, it really doesn't have quite as much effect, but I think you can certainly, I'm sure that, well, obviously there certainly are experiments where you're in the lowest lambda level, so the one-third goes through and the two-fifths doesn't, and he does have experiments like that. So you can certainly, in the lowest lambda level, where you have very strong magnetic fields, and again, usually for fractions, you need a wider constriction. If you try to pinch it off too much, you lose it much easier. Now, whether you can have, but undoubtedly there are situations where you could have one and a third going through and see things like that. And I think in single constrictions, okay, so I think experiments on single constrictions do seem to show that you can get in a regime where it looks like some of the fractions go through with wider constrictions, but I'm not sure what's been done on the interference. Mati, can you comment on that, or is there, not listening? No, to what extent can you get good systems where, say, you have a 1 2/3 going through the constriction, the 1 1/3, let's say, where the 1/3 goes through the constriction very nicely, and you have a good plateau at 1 1/3 in the constriction, and you can do interference experiments there too. Your interference was on the between 1 1/3 and 1, so that's less than the 1/3 isn't going completely through. Minus epsilon. Right, but you get 4/3 plus epsilon at all? Is he? Can you say it loud enough so that the speaker can hear? I don't know about the rest. Plus epsilon, yeah. Whether there's no data on that yet, but there will be. There will be. Yeah, so how quantitative? So again, I just talked about the weak backscattering case. So in the weak backscattering case, so there isn't a good theory that takes into account all of the, if you try to take into account all the edge states and everything, there are a lot of parameters. So I don't think it's really possible. The thing you can extract most easily is the period. You can look at where the zeros are, and so they fit it to a cosine, to a product of two cosines, and you can get a pretty good position for where the zero is. And when you take the zero, if you look at where the zeros occur, that was where v times tau was equal to pi or something like that. Tau is the length divided by the velocity. So you can extract from that a velocity. Okay. The actual shape, well, so it's not a perfect cosine, so it doesn't fit exactly. Is there a phase shift? I don't know. I haven't tried to really look at it. But so it's at least roughly right. It does. They see two or three oscillations, and this was in the weak backscattering case. In the strong backscattering case, it's more Coulomb blockade-like, so you see higher harmonics. It looks a little bit different, but where it's in the weak backscattering case, they seem to see two or three zeros on each side, so you can pretty well fit a period, and they get a number out. The number for the velocity is a very reasonable number for a typical velocity. If you try to see, you know, these are done. So these were in the Aronoff bone. This was sort of a dot, which is like 5 microns on a side. So the perimeter is about 20 microns. It goes around several times without the temperature is low enough. So if you try to estimate, is that reasonable? Everything seems to be reasonable. The velocity, I think it's like 4 × 10⁵. 6? Yeah, 4 × 10⁶, right. Centimeters per second. 14. Well, yeah, okay, if you want to think about it in terms of interference. Well, of course, you can always interpret things a lot of different ways. So fractional statistics, you can always avoid fractional statistics completely if you talk about composite fermions. Then you don't have fractional statistics, you have attached flux. But you need one or the other, I think, if you want to understand what's going on. But again, if you could probably work hard enough and avoid ever using either attached flux or, then you're using a picture of, say, a Laughlin state, which implies this fractional statistics. So I would say it's a test. The simplest analysis goes either by, you can either use fractional statistics or flux attachment. I think, you know, I don't know which one is easier. You get the same answer and they're equivalent, obviously. Yeah. So again, so the idea is that the Coulomb, what I call Coulomb dominant, by the way, so it's interference. So our picture is that if you're in the weak backscattering case, you would think about it as interference in either case. The question is what determines the interference phase as a function of magnetic field. And in the Coulomb dominated case, that's where charging energy is very large. And that tends to be a smaller dot than the capacitance is small. So the charging energy is large, and the normal situation. The situation where the charging energy can be kind of neglected, and you see the other slope, which I call Arnold foam, is where the charging energy is very small. To get it small, you want one, a large area dot, and a top gate. So these are experiments, and I think Mutti's lab, they've also seen something similar. You take a large area dot, and you put a gate on top of it, so the capacitance is as large as possible. That drives that Coulomb energy down. I think, and for a large area dot with a top gate, then the capacitance goes down as 1/area, and the edge energies go down as 1/length. So you're helped by that. I mean, if you don't have a top gate, then the capacitance doesn't go down very much. It only goes down as the perimeter. It doesn't. So I think you really probably need the top gate in order to see it in practice. Is that what you want?